This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, remember supply chains? Yeah, we sure do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 29th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Just because we haven't talked about it in a good long while on this program, for really good reasons, to be sure. There has been lots else going on in this economy. But we begin today with a data point or two. Prices, actually, of what it costs to get a 40-foot container full of stuff from Asia over here, the West Coast, to be clear. Yesterday, according to the Freightos Baltic Index, said 40-foot container would have cost $7,599 to cross the Pacific. At its high less than a year ago, $20,586.11. I don't know what the 11 cents is about. Anyway, it is getting cheaper, which is good and bad. Because you remember when all the supply chain talk was about clogged ports? Well, that hasn't gone away. The biggies like Los Angeles and Long Beach are still working to smooth things out. And the port of Oakland, well, they've about had it with how long shipping containers are sitting there, just parked at its terminals. So it's cutting the number of days, Oakland is, that those containers can stay there from 7 to 4. And it's considering new fees for containers that just kind of hang around too long as well. And Oakland's not the only place where what is technically called vessel dwell time is on the rise. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going.
Dwell time is how long a container sits around on a ship or at a port or in front of a rail line. Zach Rogers teaches supply chain management at Colorado State.
Ports are all about turnover. So you want to have containers and inventory turning through the docks as quickly as possible.
Dwell times have jumped during the pandemic. Like at the Port of Los Angeles, they've more than doubled. One reason? Wholesalers and retailers have too much inventory, and they've been running out of warehouse space.
So they started to leave inventory and containers on the ports as sort of like ad hoc free warehousing space.
The ports didn't want that. So Gene Soroka at the Port of LA says they tried diplomacy, conversation.
Nothing moved the needle.
And then they said they were going to charge a fine, starting at $100 a day per container.
And once we announced that fine on October 25th, we saw those aging containers drop by 75%.
Now, the fine hasn't actually gone into effect yet. Apparently, the threat was enough of a financial incentive for the cargo owners to get their stuff and go. That's only possible, of course, if there's somewhere to go and some way to get there. Enough trucks and rail cars. And Soroka says dwell times are rising again on the railroad that connects to the port. In part because of all the folders and marble notebooks and calculators. Do kids still use calculators? Arriving ahead of back-to-school season. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Here with your perhaps unwelcome but still very, very necessary reminder that this pandemic is not over. We may be done with it. It, however, is not done with us, which is why Eli Lilly said today it is going to supply the federal government with another 150,000 doses of its COVID antibody drug at a low, low taxpayer price of about $275 million. It is very welcome news for medical professionals who've been dealing with a whole lot of uncertainty about how long government-funded COVID therapeutics are going to last. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
Federal funding to fight the pandemic is running low, though the White House is trying to get Congress to authorize more. So doctors like Duke University's Cameron Wolf have a lot of questions about supplies of COVID therapeutics, including Lilly's bebtelovimab.
What's the supply that's going to continue to be provided by the federal government? How long will that last? How much warning do I have that this may change eventually to a commercial market?
The supply of Lilly's treatment is being watched closely now. Michigan-based pharmacist Nicholas Torney of Munson Medical Center specializes in infectious diseases. He says just a few months ago, there were multiple agents they could use to treat COVID patients.
But then the virus mutated, and now we only have bebtelovimab as the only monoclonal antibody for treatment at this point.
A pivot by Lilly and other drug makers towards selling their COVID treatments on the commercial market is a very realistic scenario, says Carrie Chan of Columbia's Business School. And she says that worries her.
These are new medications. We are years away from having cheap generic options. And so for those without insurance, it becomes inaccessible.
Some therapeutics have been hard to get even with the government paying for them, says Rob Relier, a programmer who built and runs a series of websites aimed at helping people find them in their communities.
It's scary to know that supply is not guaranteed going forward.
Especially as new variants continue to emerge. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of calm, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Abortion is or will soon be banned or sharply restricted in a growing number of states in this country. Other states are going the other way, expanding access to reproductive care. And one way those states are doing that is by expanding the workforce. For decades in the state of Maryland, abortions could only be done by licensed physicians. This Friday, though, a new law goes into effect there that will let other qualified healthcare professionals perform the procedure. Physicians, assistants, nurse practitioners, and nurse midwives among them. From Baltimore, Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that story.
When this law about qualified providers was passed this spring, nurse midwife Erin Wright realized she could legally be trained to perform abortions.
My first reaction was finally, because these are skill sets that are not difficult to learn. We really already have them.
Wright has her doctorate in nursing practice and delivers babies at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. She's also a professor at the School of Nursing there. Wright says she knows she's capable of performing early abortions.
Early abortion care is medication abortion. It's the same prescription that we often would write if somebody had an early pregnancy loss,
which is another term for a miscarriage. Wright expects midwives will also be able to end pregnancies in other ways, using certain in-office procedures to physically remove the fetus. And Wright says Maryland's law is important now because there already aren't enough providers here to meet the demand.
We are one of the southernmost states on the eastern seaboard that actually is not only providing but expanding access to abortion care. So we are about to see a big influx of people from other states who are going to require these services.
In anticipation of that influx, another nurse midwife, Morgan Nuzzo, is partnering with a physician to open what they call an all-trimester abortion clinic in College Park, Maryland.
We got the keys on Wednesday, and we started renovations on Thursday, and we hope to open in the fall.
They're buying their equipment from a clinic in Savannah, Georgia that's closing. Under specific circumstances, Maryland does allow abortions relatively late in pregnancy into the third trimester. And this will be one of only a handful of clinics in the country that offers that.
A lot of our patients that come either have a bad fetal diagnosis or some sort of life-threatening situation where they're usually flying from somewhere else in the country to get to us.
Nuzzo says Maryland's new law was instrumental in the decision to locate the clinic here.
We knew that I would have full scope of practice, and I knew that I would be able to bring in other midwives, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, and that we would be able to train them.
By the end of the year, 19 states in Washington, D.C. will allow advanced practice clinicians, in addition to physicians, to perform abortions, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a reproductive health policy organization. Maryland's new law also provides $3.5 million annually to train people in how to perform abortions. Elizabeth Nash is a state policy analyst with Guttmacher.
That's very uncommon. I don't know of another state that has a line item for abortion training.
Some are critical of the job expansion. Laura Bogley is legislative director for Maryland Right to Life. She says this law promotes what she calls abortion tourism.
Maryland abortion law is regressive at this point. We're going in the wrong direction. We're not ensuring that abortions are safer, reducing that standard of care.
Maryland's governor, Republican Larry Hogan, vetoed the bill on similar grounds. That veto was overridden by the state legislature.
It repealed one of the few health and safety regulations on abortion practices that the state of Maryland was allowing that required only licensed physicians to perform abortion.
Back at Johns Hopkins, nurse midwife Erin Wright points out abortion procedures have advanced since Maryland passed the law in the early 90s, stipulating that only physicians perform them.
The previous laws went in place and before there was such a thing as medication abortion. And most things really were surgical. And that is not the case anymore, and it hasn't been for a very long time.
Wright was at the hospital last Friday when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade.
I was actually on labor and delivery when the news came out. And so everybody became very quiet for a moment. And then we all just got to work because that is our job, is to get to work taking care of patients.
Wright says as a midwife, it's her responsibility to take care of anyone with a uterus. That can include delivering babies, performing a gynecological exam, or prescribing birth control. And she's preparing for a future where her job will include performing abortions. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
First, we had the Russians using social media to interfere with American elections. It's not partisan, by the way, that's just fact. Anyway, today we learn the Chinese are using social media to mess with the American economy. Researchers at a key cybersecurity company say a Chinese group impersonated Americans on social media so that they could undermine U.S. production of rare earth elements. You've heard about them, certainly. We've talked about them here. Critical components in almost everything from fuel cells to cell phones. So, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore now on what this might tell us about the U.S.-China economic relationship.
Earlier this month, a chorus of social media accounts that appeared to be based in Texas started warning that a proposed rare earth element refinery there would cause radiation poisoning, toxic waste, and threats to livelihood.
But these people weren't real.
John Holtquist is a vice president of Mandiant, a cybersecurity firm.
These are hundreds of accounts, essentially part of an information operation.
Mandiant says the entity responsible is a pro-Chinese Communist Party group that's well-resourced and grew out of information campaigns targeting Hong Kong. Mandiant hasn't nailed down who's behind it, but
the Chinese government is probably our primary suspect.
A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in D.C. said China is one of the biggest victims of disinformation and opposes its creation and dissemination. Rare earth elements are crucial to electric vehicles, cell phones, missiles, supermagnets, and other advanced technologies. China currently controls more than 80% of global production.
China is probably seeking to maintain their leverage, their control over this marketplace.
This current campaign, if sponsored by the Chinese government, would mark a departure from previous efforts, which have been more political in nature. John Bateman is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It is more unusual to see a very granular attack on specific Western companies that are competitors with China.
One reason may be that the stakes for China aren't just economic, says Maggie Bachman, who has researched Chinese political influence campaigns.
They rely on high GDP growth and proven economic outcomes to justify their one-party rule system. So economic outcomes are crucial to their political stability.
Carnegie's Bateman says this operation was ultimately ineffective, but it may be a sign that other sensitive industries could be next. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I was going to be the focus of investigation or arrest.
Well, that can't be good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 82 points today, just over 0.25%, 31,029. The NASDAQ down 3 points. We'll call that flat, 11,177. The S&P 500 gave up 2, also flat, 38,18. We are in peak allergy season for some out there. That time when many breathe in the fragrance of summer flowers and sneeze and eyes water and that whole deal. If all that pollen has your eyes watering, you are in good company. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates something like 60 million people a year are affected by seasonal allergies. The market research company Ibis World estimates the over-the-counter allergy medicine manufacturing market, $3.8 billion this year. So some allergy-adjacent companies, perhaps. GlaxoSmithKline, they make the allergy spray Flonase, up 0.9%. Sanofi, maker of Allegra, up 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You go to a big summer concert or maybe a festival over a couple of days and you want to have a good time. Everybody does. Recreational drugs are part of that for a lot of people, but more and more fentanyl is showing up in some of those drugs. Highly potent, sometimes lethal fentanyl. And that's got the people who run those summer concerts and festivals worried about accidental overdoses. So some of the promoters are making overdose reversal medication available, but distribution of it is another thing entirely, as Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville.
The night is young, and Bonnaroo will be rocking until daybreak. At big multi-day concert festivals like this one on an isolated farm in Tennessee, attendees don't have too much trouble getting drugs past security. And more, those drugs can be deadly. Ecstasy is being laced with the cheap and powerful synthetic opioid fentanyl. A 26-year-old who died at Bonnaroo in 2019 had both in his system. Medics all carry the overdose reversal drug naloxone, but they can't always get to someone in time. So Inglet Traverse Hayward is now flooding festivals with the life-saving nasal spray.
We are showing up with it in huge quantities.
She and her husband started a nonprofit crisscrossing the country, distributing naloxone donated by the manufacturer, Hikma Pharmaceuticals. They handed out 2,500 doses just at Bonnaroo. The reversal drug kits are difficult to find and can cost more than $100 without insurance.
What we're learning is that all these people know what naloxone is. They've even known people who have come back to life because of naloxone, but we're able to be the people who give them their actual first kit.
Public health agencies increasingly recommend that even non-drug users carry naloxone, but often the government takes a back seat on so-called harm reduction. Lori Tremel Freeman, who's CEO of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, says laws and policies vary by state. Naloxone, for instance, remains a prescription drug.
It's a fine line to walk, and health departments try to stay, you know, within the bounds of the law while also just communicating actively and getting good public health education out there.
Even more taboo among concert promoters is helping users test their drugs for fentanyl. They don't want to be seen as condoning drug use, and the test strips have been considered drug paraphernalia by some states. A company called Bunk Police, whose founder goes by the pseudonym Adam Auchter, sells them at festivals, but goes in undercover because promoters are worried about liability.
They have in the past given us a long list of insurance requirements, and we have scoured the planet, I kid you not, for underwriters that will insure us in this circumstance.
Now, Auchter sneaks into festivals a few days early, hiding in the woods to evade security.
We barely even ask for permission to come anymore. We know that they will say no to us.
But there is great need, says Auchter. He doesn't use his real name because part of his role is tracing back laced drugs and convincing dealers to destroy their entire supply. Mitchell Gomez is the executive director of Dance Safe, which follows promoters' rules. Where allowed, his nonprofit sets up a tent with a tabletop machine that screens drugs for fentanyl.
Like, drug checking is not an option anymore. It's a thing that anyone who uses substances has to do.
Fentanyl overdoses, often from laced substances, are now the top cause of death for young adults. Gomez says that grim trend line is softening some promoters, though still not the largest, like Live Nation, which responded to our questions about allowing fentanyl testing by saying in an email that Bonnaroo is always looking for ways to, quote, take care of and educate our patrons. But Gomez sees potential liability working both ways.
If somebody dies at your event from something that DanceSafe could have prevented and we reached out to you about being on site and you turned us down, I actually think that probably created some liability as well.
When he's not allowed to check drugs, Gomez says he still hands out information about the dangers of fentanyl and earplugs, a non-controversial form of music festival harm reduction. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
At last count, according to the Census and Statistics Department of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, there are 1,457 companies that have regional headquarters in Hong Kong. 254 of them are American companies, 252 of them are based on the Chinese mainland. Japan, the UK, and France round out the top five. And I mention it because it's going to be 25 years this Friday that the Brits handed Hong Kong back to Beijing. 25 years out of the 50 that China promised it would let things stay basically as they were in what was a free-willing center of global finance. Hong Kong, to be clear, does still have a lot going for it economically, but it ain't what it used to be. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack walks us through a quarter of a century of doing business in Hong Kong after the handover.
Hong Kong in the 1980s and 90s was exciting, vibrant, a trendsetter, thanks to the likes of local pop star Anita Mui, referred to as the Madonna of the East. By 1992, when British criminal lawyer Michael Vidler arrived in Hong Kong, he says you could really see the display of wealth.
You would see street cleaners with pagers, if not slightly large mobile phones.
Hong Kong was the go-between for the world and mainland China, which was still pretty closed. Hundreds of thousands doubted that Hong Kong would keep its openness under Chinese rule and left it, including my relatives. On June 30th, 1997, Britain's national anthem played for the last time in Hong Kong. Among those at the handover ceremony who wasn't sad to see that was American businessman Benjamin Schwal. He says he and his business friends got matching dragon tattoos to celebrate the handover.
The handover to us was symbolic of the China century, and Hong Kong was the epicenter of it.
After China's flag was raised, Shuol says Hong Kong remained his banking, transport, and social hub in Asia.
We had almost two decades of real success, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without Hong Kong. But then it began to fade a little bit.
Because mainland China became more open, he says, and Hong Kong is becoming more closed. After anti-government protests in 2019, Beijing pushed through a national security law that targeted dissenters in Hong Kong.
From that moment, there was a realization for me, certainly, that my time in Hong Kong was numbered.
Again, lawyer Michael Vidler. He's taken on some of the most high-profile human rights cases in Hong Kong. In April, he says his name appeared in Beijing-friendly newspapers and alleged that he is a lawyer for protesters and anti-China groups with American backing. Accusations he denies.
I saw that I was going to be the focus of investigation or arrest, you know, for doing nothing more than doing my job, which is to be a public interest lawyer.
Within 48 hours of those news articles coming out, he left Hong Kong. And it isn't just the political situation. COVID has also complicated life in the Chinese territory. Between June 2020 and June 2021, nearly 90,000 people out of a population of 7 million left Hong Kong, according to official statistics. Rocky Tung of the Financial Services Development Council, a government advisory body, thinks this outflow has to do with travel restrictions to contain the COVID-19 pandemic, which is worrying for him.
Business travels and the success of Hong Kong as an international financial center has always been highly correlated.
He hopes the COVID travel restrictions will be lifted because, he says, Hong Kong is still an attractive financial hub. If you're a U.S. firm focused on China, he says, unlike the mainland, Hong Kong has no capital controls and it's an arbitration hub. He says the national security law doesn't affect any of this.
Meaning, so long as businesses are not carrying out anything that is disrupting national security, then they will be able to run their business just like the previous 23 or 25 years.
Hong Kong's last British governor, Chris Patten, isn't convinced. Sure, he says, the national security law has only targeted activists, Hong Kong politicians like Martin Lee, and local media mogul Jimmy Lai. But
businessmen should understand that ultimately, the law for Martin Lee or for Jimmy Lai is sooner or later the law for them as well.
Chinese leaders once promised that Hong Kong's system will not change for 50 years. We're now at the halfway mark. In China, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that, boy, I'll tell you, central bankers sure do know how to travel, huh? There's a big central bank meeting in Portugal today, the European Central Bank's annual policy conference, for what it's worth. Federal Reserve, by the way, they go to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Have a nice time there. Anyway, Jay Powell is in Portugal, and points for consistency. Powell said today, and this is a quote, "Is there a risk we would go too far? Certainly there's a risk. The bigger mistake to make," Powell said, "would be to fail to restore price stability," end of quote. Price stability, of course, is inflation. That will be the topic du jour, two days, next Fed meeting, 26, 27 July. All right, got a boogie. Here is your moment of economic context, just because I'm a history guy and I think this is interesting. Also, if you're listening to this stuck on an interstate highway someplace, this one's for you. Today in 1956, President Eisenhower signed the Federal Highway Act, which established the interstate highway system, at the time the biggest public works project this country had ever seen. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.